Hello and good evening, everybody. We are live with our dear friend of the channel, Charlie Robinson. And the question of the evening is, did intelligence block Epstein client list with a focus on the Mossad, the CIA, the FBI? Charlie Robinson, if you're not familiar, he is the author of his own podcast, Macro Aggression, and we've also got the Octopus of Global Control book, which is mind-blowing audiobook I would recommend as well. He's a prolific author. There's other books. I've got his X. I've got all his links in the description box. So please support Charlie's important work. And we've had an array of experts on the subject so far with a variety of opinions. So I'm going to be fascinated to hear what our friend Charlie has to say. I mean, is this upside down land, my friend, like Candace Owens described?
Well, I'm glad that people are talking about Jeffrey Epstein, even if they're mad about there not being a big data dump. I don't know what they expected, because whoever controls those files, be it Jeffrey Epstein, the FBI, Mossad, whoever has the files has the power. So they're not going to voluntarily give up their power. I think that there was an unrealistic expectation from the community that there's going to be some big database spreadsheet that was going to come out, and you're going to be able to look through it and find your favorite person on there and say, see, they were in this network. The truth is, I mean, the files, air quotes, and the lists, they exist already. I mean, you can read Whitney Webb's book, One Nation Under Blackmail, Volume 2, and find a great network of co-conspirators. You can find Epstein flight logs. I mean, the information is out there, but I recognize that it's a salacious topic, and it makes for amazing headlines. And anytime you're talking about trafficking children, underage girls mostly, but you know, children in general, it's disgusting and gross. And we need to talk about it. But my big hope is that it doesn't get left at just a guy who is running sexual blackmail entrapment operations. Because as you and I both know, Jeffrey Epstein was so much more than that. And the other areas of expertise that he was involved in are equally interesting and just as disturbing. And you, what you find is that this guy had his fingers in everything. So,
I just want to read this quote from Assange. The reason the FBI wouldn't let the Epstein client list come out in court is because if they did, the blackmail would no longer be useful and the CIA would lose control over all the powerful people they spent decades setting up. What are your thoughts on that, Charlie?
That's it. That's the answer. It's so valuable. The PR nightmare, who cares? Cash Patel and Pam Bondi and Dan Bongino, they can take the fall for it. They're disposable people. That's what they're brought in for. They're cutouts that are going to get recycled through this. They'll pin all this on them. But in the end, Assange is correct. That there's no reason, there's no benefit for them to release all this information, because it appears that the information does not have an expiration date on it. You know, it's one thing if you're cheating on your wife, or if you're a closeted homosexual and this information comes out. Well, it comes out and then you're outed and you're embarrassed and you go through the ringer and then you come out the other side and nobody really cares all that much. But if it's child related, then they've got you. They've got you for as long as they need you, and they'll make you dance forever. And so a guy like Epstein puts people in situations. So client list, I mean, I don't even know what that means necessarily, because he invited a ton of people to his island for a variety of reasons. Sometimes it was fun with physics. You know, it was a bunch of scientist nerds that he would get there, and then they'd magically get lucky with some girl, right? That when they never could in the rest of their lifetime, they just magically, this girl wants to give them a massage. So he entrapped a lot of people, but I don't know that I would call it like a client list necessarily. I mean, it could be a list of people who are victims, but in order to be one of Jeffrey Epstein's, quote, clients, you can't possibly be that much of a victim. You might be one of his victims, but you're no victim yourself, because by the fact that he's got the goods on you, you are engaging in some criminal behavior that you don't want people to know about. So there are no good guys in this situation, and it encompasses the entire octopus of Washington, D.C., and London, and Tel Aviv. And there's a lot of people under its control, and it's not just politicians, and it's not just bankers.
And you think this guy that's on the screen is still being protected?
Yeah. Yeah, this is, and we could talk about Epstein's role in starting the Clinton Global Initiative. That's a huge money laundering operation that was stealing tons of money. I mean, I'm just grateful that people know that there are Epstein-esque figures that exist out there, and that's how a lot of politics actually gets done. When people are starting to, they ask like, why is the government so broken? Well, because they bring in corrupted people who are broken themselves and put them in positions of high power, but only after they've been compromised properly. And so they're not acting like bad people accidentally. This is in their nature. And I think there's an assumption with the general public that, oh, the best and brightest will go to Washington to get the job done. And it's like, no. The people who are drawn to power the most, and who are those? Psychopaths? Yeah, sociopath. I mean, you can look at the percentages, and it shows that in that Beltway region of Washington, D.C. and the area, disproportionately high numbers of psychopaths. Not surprising. That industry gives them all the things that they need. And I saw that comment go across that the Clinton Global Initiative was involved in Texas. Yeah, what could possibly go wrong? Like missing kids, like there was in Haiti? So this is how it happens. They traffic children through NGOs, through groups that they control, that are sort of public-private partnerships. They go into disaster areas and set up there as a way to offer relief and help. And this isn't limited to the Clinton Global Initiative. I mean, the United Nations has a long string of rapes. Everywhere they go in to help out, they wind up leaving a ton of victims. So this is what they've done. They do this everywhere they go, and they use these groups as a cover to traffic children. And in the heights of a disaster, when there's chaos and communication lines are broken down, you don't know how many kids are supposed to be in Haiti until Laura Silsby from the Clinton Foundation gets busted crossing the line of the border into the Dominican Republic with a bunch of kids and gets put in jail. And Bill Clinton has to fly out there on a private jet and get her released by himself. So there's trafficking going on. Epstein knew this. He was involved in it. His partners were Bill Clinton. He set up the Clinton Global Initiative. You know, follow those leads. Like, go from there. And I think most people will be disturbed, but unfortunately not surprised at what goes on, the criminality that goes on inside all of our governments.
So, viewers, if you've got any questions, we're live with Charlie Robinson. Please put your questions in the chat, and please support Charlie at his links. And I think this question here from Trevor kind of encompasses the frustration many people are feeling with Bondi, Patel, and the whole crew, because they were so emphatic about releasing this information. I mean, for years they've been talking about it. Trevor's saying, why did Trump go on record and clearly state he released a list of names connected with Jeffrey? So for them to just do this massive about turn, you know, people are tearing the hair out, even hardcore Trump supporters who are relying on this information coming forth. There's all kinds of theories floating around. I've been watching Luke, Tim Pool. We had Lionel on. We had Professor Hamamoto on. Hamamoto thinks it's some kind of ninja strategy that Trump is employing to maintain the value of the files. Others just think that Trump has been told by the deep state, this is how it's going to be. Like Putin said, these presidents come in idealistic, and when the guys with the briefcases and the suits show up, they're told how it's going to be, and it just changes overnight. So what do you think, Charlie, about all of the various theories floating around?
I would love to be optimistic and think that this is part of some elaborate plan by Donald Trump to hold on to the leverage of this file. I tend to lean more towards Putin's a description of how things really play out. I mean, they show you this is the agenda. There's some things I think you have latitude to kind of do this way or that way. I think maybe when Trump says, you know, he's going to clearly, you know, he's going to release the names, maybe he means it. I mean, I don't know, but let's just say he did. He means it. You can talk about it all day long, but at some point you're going to get the real, the way it's really going to go down. And the men with the briefcases visit you. Actually, it's the men with the black hats and the long beard who all stand around the president's desk and pose for pictures every administration, where there's 15 of them and they all look exactly the same. And we all know who I'm talking about. Those are the guys that come in and tell you, you're not releasing that. Because if you do, here are the consequences. Maybe they need to spell it out. Maybe they don't. I think their reputation precedes them. There are certain things that you have the flexibility to talk about, and there are others that you don't. And who Jeffrey Epstein was working with and the information that he compiled over the years is extremely valuable, and we know which country was behind him. I mean, we know which countries, plural, were behind him. And so my assumption is that, you know, who's to say that there's only one so-called file, too? I mean, if I'm Jeffrey Epstein and I've got this file that's worth a bunch of money, and I've got Bill Gates and he's compromised, and I say to him, want to buy a file? You want to buy a copy of the file in case you need it in the future for all your, you know, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Gavi stuff, all the climate stuff you're doing? You want to have a life, you know, an insurance policy? I'll sell it to you for $1 billion. I mean, you don't think that? I mean, I'm of the belief that this file may exist in multiple locations. It is like a bomb. Okay, there is no sense defusing the bomb after it already goes off. You can out these people who are involved in it. But once you do, you have used your bomb, okay? And then after that, you've got to go back to the drawing board and get more compromising information on people. Maybe a calculation has been made that we don't need Jeffrey Epstein's anymore. With the technology that we have, I mean, we can make it look like anything. I mean, with AI and this and that, I don't need to get you on film doing this. I can just make a video that looks exactly like you are doing it, send it to all the wrong people, have it secretly leak as a file that, you know, got leaked out from the Epstein thing, and next thing you know, you're cooked. I mean, they can do this digitally right now without you even needing to be compromised. So we're in a whole new era. I think that my concern with Bill Gates' relationship to Jeffrey Epstein is less about little girls and more about eugenics, because these guys were working on something. And Jeffrey Epstein donated $30 million to Harvard, to Martin Nowak, to finance evolutionary dynamics and population game theory. So he's working on computer simulation programs that show what happens when you insert variables into the population, you know, like viruses and things like that. And he's funding these guys at Harvard while he's simultaneously running some operation in New Mexico at Zorro Ranch. And so we get, you know, come for the sexual blackmail entrapment, stay for the depopulation. You know, this guy was up to no good on a variety of fronts. not just the least of which selling arms and running Ponzi schemes and partnering with Les Wexner and Southern Air Transport and all the various things that he was doing. But on top of all of that, his late in life pivot towards being involved in eugenics and depopulation programs is probably the scariest.
Indeed. Ray J is asking, if it is part of a plan, can Trump's credibility last long enough to play it out?
It's a good question. It's a good question. If it is, if he is sort of playing this role, I don't know. He better get to it. I mean, if I'm Trump, I'm not buying green bananas. You know what I mean? Like he's a danger. He's a danger to this group in some respects. I mean, he's controllable for sure by certain people, but also kind of a wild card. I think they would prefer him to be out of the way. And so when you're Trump and you've already got a bunch of people that don't like you, maybe you don't add to your woes by getting on the wrong side of the black hat crew, because you know what'll happen. I mean, you just know what will happen. You and your entire family will blow up in an airplane accident or something like that. This is just, he can fool himself if he wants to, but I think a calculation has been made for his own personal safety that this information just really can't go out. I mean, and I'd love to indulge myself in the fantasies that this is 4D chess and that he's walking them into some trap. And I hope that is the case, right? I would love to be massively wrong about that, but I just think that he's making a calculation to stay alive at this point.
So a lot of people are asking about the timing of the meeting with Netanyahu, the Peace Prize nomination, etc. And, you know, perhaps this ties into what we were going to talk about with the Mossad.
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder, you know that Netanyahu likes to bring his dirty laundry when he comes to the White House and have them do it for him. That's a little inside scoop on his visits, just as an additional act of subservience. You know, when the boss comes to town, you got to shine his shoes. I think Benjamin Netanyahu is one of the most dangerous people on the planet right now. He is deeply involved in an ongoing genocide. He is desperate to start World War III for no other reason than to keep himself out of prison or worse. And he is trying to suck the United States into an unwinnable war in Iran in order to fight their enemies, not ours. And I can tell you from the ground here in the United States, there is zero appetite for this from Americans. Nobody wants a part of this. Like you can feel however you want about the Muslim community, but there's still very little interest in an attack. And in fact, on the contrary, it's becoming obvious to just about everybody who's really in control of the American government, almost to an extent where you feel like maybe they want you to know because it's so obvious. And, you know, the boss comes to town and then he brings this cheap flattery of let's get Trump some sort of honor for stopping the war that he was instrumental in financing, supplying, and starting. And running logistics for, if not outright participating in, you know what I mean? It's perfect. Actually, it's perfect for the American empire. It's Donald Trump starts a war, then stops it, then gives himself the Nobel Peace Prize. I love it. It's so perfectly MAGA. I can't even stand it.
So do you think the ceasefire is just a charade? It's just a reload opportunity?
Yeah.
And that Israel realized they bit off more than they could chew with the dome getting penetrated and, you know, think bombs landing on major structures in Israel for the first time in a long time. And that regime change is the ultimate objective.
Yeah. yes to all of that. I think that they are reloading. They have to. I think that they're going back to the drawing board. You can say what you want about the Israelis. They are smart. They will figure out a flaw in the plan, or if they believe that it benefits them to hit Iran five times harder than Iran hits them, they will do that without hesitation. I think a big flaw, an Achilles heel of the Israeli defense, has been exposed, though, with these systems, these iron domes, which look more like iron sieves and can be easily distracted with drones that can make them think that their things are coming in where they're not, or get them to trade a $1 million missile for a $20,000 drone. And you do that night after night after night. There's only so many missiles that can come in. There's only so many dollars. Well, I was going to say there's only so many dollars the Americans can give them, but I suppose that's kind of endless. But you can still bleed them to death financially by doing these small little attacks. And then clearly the hypersonic missiles are a big problem for Israel. And it doesn't take a whole lot to psychologically traumatize a nation, especially one as schizophrenic as Israel. You start setting off a couple of these missiles in residential areas or malls, or take out the airports, or take out the water treatment facilities or the power plants and things like that, and put a city into darkness, or take them back to the Stone Age for a couple of months, and you're going to have massive outrage in the streets, and they'll be calling for Netanyahu's head. So he's in a very dangerous and precarious spot, because he needs to start a war, but he's deeply unpopular inside his own country. They don't dare regime change Netanyahu in the middle of a war. So he's got every incentive, all these perverse incentives, to keep these wars going, just to keep himself alive and out of prison. So, but that can only last so long if the population is getting hammered night after night by these rockets. And by the way, the PR battle for Israel is a catastrophe right now. They are losing the PR battle on every front, and it's tough, because, like it or not, you can win a war, but you also have to sell it to your general public. And if you've lost the ability to sell it to your people, and the Israelis are always up for a fight, if you can't sell it to them, then you've got big problems. The international community is 100% against all of this. So there's no appetite for this fight. And I think that everybody's seen the United States as being an embarrassment right now on the world stage, and being led around by Israel. And it's obvious to everybody with the eyes to see it.
So Trevor's asking as to whether the Iraq weapons of mass destruction lie during the Bush blur era is just being repeated now with Iran, the pretext for Iran.
Well, to be fair, the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq wasn't technically a lie. They did have weapons of mass destruction at one point, and the reason why America knew that was because Rumsfeld sold them to them. They sold them the chemical weapons to use against Iran in the 80s. So when they talk about they've got this yellow cake, we're going to look for their weapons of mass destruction, it's like, what makes you so sure that they've got them? Well, we've got the receipt from when they bought them from us, you know, like two decades ago. So but you can see that plan or some version of that happening with Iran. It's probably not going to be weapons of mass destruction. I mean, they've been trying to sell the nuclear, you know, 3 weeks away, 3 months away, 3 years away from enriching uranium. They've been selling that for 30 years, and nobody's buying that. I will tell you this, I can envision a scenario in which it's not so much that they accuse Iran of weapons of mass destruction, but what happens is that somebody, i.e. Israel, attacks American bases in Iraq, and then it gets blamed on Iran. And they say, see, they're hitting Americans now, and that's the pretense to go in. So not weapons of mass destruction per se, but they can pin it on them that you blew up our guys in Jordan, or you got our guys in Syria who are doing nothing except, you know, stealing oil, or our guys in Iraq who have been there forever and are never leaving. So, you know, if something were to happen to them, you know, if Trump comes out and says, you know, we're not getting involved in World War III unless our guys get hit directly by Iran, and then a month later, our guys get hit directly by Iran, you can bet your ass that it's not Iran, because they have no incentive to do that. That is a strategically stupid thing to do when you know that when you want to fight the other guy, the crazy guy in your neighborhood, but you don't want the big football player to kick your ass too. So you don't start two fights at once. You focus on one. So if anything happens to America, I think the difference between now and 20 years ago, to answer his question, is that we remember weapons of mass destruction, and it's been so memeified over the years that they can't pull that off without it just being a classic joke. We've seen this one before. So in some respects, we can't get the weapons of mass destruction lie again, because it wouldn't work. It's been discredited, along the same lines as babies on the incubators, to die on the floor, the cold floor, that lie. You can't sell it after it's been mocked for decades.
And let's not forget that Iran's nuclear aspirations have been decimated and obliterated by this supreme bombing in the history of Top Gun movies, the best thing ever to happen in the history of military history in the entire universe. So Iran, they can't use that again. They've played that one, because it's been obliterated so well. So they've got to come up with something else now to go back in. So viewers, Charlie's saying they are going to go back in to Iran. Possible false flag. What other scenarios could you see, pretext could you see they come up with?
Well, I could see them also, I could see the West mining the Strait of Hormuz and taking out Saudi ships or Israeli ships or something like that coming out through the Strait of Hormuz and blaming it on the Iranians as well. So it doesn't necessarily have to be a missile attack or a drone swarm attack on a U.S. base. It could be, insert the name of the ship, of course, and it'll go through there unsuspecting, and it'll get picked up by some mine that's been set on the ocean floor to detect a certain frequency, and boom, next thing you know, that ship will go to the bottom of the ocean. I would immediately check who owns the ship and who has the insurance policy on the ship, and that would probably lead you to some of the co-conspirators as well. But things like that, I could expect something like that. I could expect them bombing a ship in the Suez Canal to and blaming it on the Iranians and things like that. So all the last things that the Iranian regime would actually do, and I'm no apologist for them, but from a strategic standpoint, these are things that you just wouldn't do unless you were serious about. I mean, they can shut down the Strait of Hormuz, and they might do that, but they have to worry about the contagion effect of what that does to all their partners in the Gulf, who ship and depend on having these maritime routes do they allow Saudi Arabia to get a free pass? I don't know. They're partners with Israelis. I mean, the crown prince is a closeted Zionist. So maybe they take out the Saudi, it's a Saudi ship, and then that draws Saudi Arabia into this in some respect. And then it fosters Muslim support, around the region, something. I don't know. I could, whatever happens and whatever the official narrative is, it will be a lie. That much I do know. So, and these are just speculative ideas based on a lifetime of watching how these people operate.
Yeah, I just love this mainstream media reaction. If you object to war with Iran, if you don't want World War III, if you value the lives of your loved ones, then you just love the Iranian regime.
Yeah, clearly.
It's like, oh. So what do you think then? It will be Israel that bombs Iran again first, or America?
I think it'll be Israel. I mean, but that is to say, with American weapons and American logistics and American support and American money and American approval and American know-how and American, everything. So, it's never just Israel when they're getting all of their gear from us. You always have to make a calculation that America is behind it, or at the very least has its fingerprints on it. whether the bombs are dropped by Israeli planes or American planes, in the end, these two regimes are hardly separable at this point. There's so much overlap and so much overt control by the Israeli government in America that their foreign policy essentially is America's foreign policy. So if I guess the answer to that question is, if Israel wants the United States to be the next group to bomb Iran, then the United States will be the next group to bomb Iran. It's whatever Israel wants, but I think that they're more likely to do it.
So we've had a variety of military commentators on, and you know, some are saying the tail's wagging the dog, etc., whereas others are saying that Israel serves as a military outpost for the globalists in the Middle East, Brzezinski-style divide and conquer in the Middle East, and to prevent Iran, China, and Russia forming this alliance that Brzezinski said was the biggest threat to U.S. hegemony. So some of the commentators said, look, we could just shut off America. We could just stop supplying weapons to Israel and shut Israel down overnight. But it's serving this function in the Middle East to create divide and conquer. So, you know, is it a symbiotic thing? Or has America got the most power and control because they got the most money and weapons? Or as Israel got all this blackmail going and they're leveraging this massive military-industrial complex out of America? I'm thinking about this all the time, Charlie, and I'm trying to grasp it because we've had so many people on with so many different opinions, but I'd be interested to hear what you think.
I would describe it as a mutually parasitic relationship.
That could lead to World War III.
There are times in which both sides benefit from this. In the United States, Israel is referred to in the medical or in the military side of things as America's permanent aircraft carrier in the Middle East. Okay, that's how we look at it. The irony is that nobody from Israel ever gets involved in the wars when the United States is in them. They never joined the Iraq war or Afghanistan. They're cheerleading it. They demand it. They want American military to carry it out. But where are the Israeli troops? Nowhere to be found. Never. They will never join. They don't do that. They don't participate. They want everybody else to go die for them, but they won't get their hands dirty on this. So it's hard to respect them. You know, it's really hard to respect them, but that is the United States views this. David Icke would describe Israel as the fiefdom of the Rothschilds, right? As this great state that they control that's semi-lawless, depending on your ethnicity, where you can hide from pedophilia charges if you choose to in that state and not be brought to justice. And so there's a ton of money laundering that runs through that. There's a variety of industries, not the least of which ecstasy and diamonds, that run through there. So it's been used as a dirty marketplace to wash money, run arms, ethnically cleanse, and launch, you know, wars of aggression against the Middle East for the last 20 plus year or 20 years at least. So Israel is a lot of things depending on who you are. If you're Palestinian, you're in an occupied land. You know, if you're an Israeli, you're a supremacist. You're a slave plantation master. But for the rest of the world watching it, it's a stain on humanity, what they've been doing over the last year plus. And dragging the world into World War III is unacceptable behavior. And I am embarrassed at the role of America in enabling and, you know, and participating in this. It is not a reflection on the American people. The American people do not want this. this is a psychotic, out of control government that's being run by a foreign nation that's making these decisions, and we have no say in it. And it's frustrating for us, but I certainly wouldn't want to be in the Palestinians' shoes, of course, because it's life or death for them.
Question from Renard. Are you seeing any parallels with the start of World War I from the last century?
Yeah, actually, it's a fantastic question, because this is what scares me the most, is that what started in World War I was a regional skirmish between two small factions, you know, two countries that had a beef with one another. And it wasn't that did it. It was the fact that they had alliances and agreements with neighboring countries that was the huge, that would turned out to be the problem. So it's not so much that, you know, you and I want to get into a fist fight with one another. If I've got a buddy with me and you've got a buddy with you, now it's going to be the four of us. And if your friends have a relationship with some guys down the street and an agreement that if we get into a fight, you got to come help us too. Now it's, now we're looking at a brawl. And that's what happened with World War I, was that it started regionally and small, and because of these legal arrangements that these countries had with one another, they were pulled into this engagement, and then it just broke off from there. Of course, it was fueled by the bankers, and we know that. So in some respects, you can see the lead up to this as being very much like World War I, in that when Israel really starts hammering Iran, and Iran says, I have defense pacts with not just Russia, but also China, and they're in now. And so they start attacking, and what do? They start knocking out bases. Well, you knock out a U.S. base, and the United States says, all right, now we're in. And they say, oh, and by the way, Article 5, NATO, now the rest of Western Europe, you're in this too. So now you get, boom, next thing you know, you have World War III. So I think there might not be an appetite for a variety of nations to join in this fight, but they may have no choice. It may be legally required because of the documents and charters that they've signed over the years.
So that leads us to Russia and Ukraine then, because, you know, among all these slaps in the faces that we've seen from the present administration, we have got the bombing of Iran. We have got no Epstein client list and the Epstein cover-up. And now we've got the rearmament of Ukraine. I mean, all it takes is to stop supplying weapons to Ukraine, and they're going to have to surrender, and the war's over. But we're seeing Orwellian perpetual war in Ukraine as well.
Yeah. This is by design. This, and again, Ukraine is... I describe it like, in America, when you go into like the deep South, you'll find these guys like rednecks that'll have like a big piece of land, right? And on this big piece of land, there's no cops anywhere around. You can do whatever you want. You want to take out your guns and shoot up stuff. You want to blow up an old car. You can do whatever you want in this old piece, in your big chunk of land, because nobody's paying attention. That's what Ukraine is. Ukraine is a big chunk of land in the backwoods somewhere where you can build biolabs, you can try to build nukes, you can run organ trafficking, you can run human smuggling, you can run Ponzi schemes, crypto scams, you can do whatever you want in this place. It is totally lawless, and they love it. And of course, the American government says, perfect, we need one of these places where we can do all the things that we're not allowed to do on our own home soil. Hell, we're not even allowed to do it in like foreign countries. We're just going to do it anyway, because we control these people. If you remember, you know, Yats is our guy. That's Victoria Nuland on a call talking about how Yatsenyuk was their guy. So we installed their government through regime changes, National Endowment for Democracy and USAID, in conjunction with the Soros Group. We regime changed Ukraine years ago so that we could use it as this backyard playpen to do unspeakable things. And it's extremely important that that grift continues. And so it's almost worth it for the American empire to keep financing this war so that they can either continue their operations, or they can wrap up their operations and get all of the incriminating evidence out of there so that they don't all wind up in handcuffs for what they've been doing. But there's a ton of money sloshing through there. There's almost no accountability. And as we all know, all wars are banker wars. So you got to look at the City of London, and you got to look at the Cayman Islands, and you got to look at Switzerland, and you'll find, you know, if you want to see what's going on with the Ukraine war, check some bank accounts. That'll tell you.
I just want to address this comment from Corinne. Sure, the Ukraine war would be over, Sean, but Ukraine would lose everything. Don't you get that? So, Corinne, my heart goes out to the people of Ukraine who have been blood sacrificed by parasites, BlackRock, Boris Johnson, the banksters, all these vested interests who have basically used that country as a proxy to try and weaken Russia and profit from it, military industrial complex, etc. And they haven't given a shit about the population of Ukraine. They are completely expendable, and you've got over a million young Ukrainians dead already because weapons have continued to be supplied when there was a peace deal on the table years ago and Boris Johnson was told to go and scupper it. And now, by keeping the arms flowing, how many more dead Ukrainians do we want to enable? Because that's all it's doing. It's just there's going to be no young people left in Ukraine. They're going to have to start bringing in mercenaries. Keir Starmer was threatening to send our lads over there. Our lads certainly don't want to go and fight this bullshit war for banksters and globalists. What would you add to that, Charlie?
It's a sunk cost right now. Like you said, there's a million dead Ukrainians. Let's make sure that there aren't 2 million. This is the direction it's going. That eastern part was Russian all along. These lines, these borders get drawn intentionally to create conflict later on. You know, when the British Empire takes over a region like in the Middle East in the early 1900s, and then they say, oh, we're going to create the country of Iraq, and we're going to, you know, and they draw these lines. You would think, you would make the assumption that they draw these lines in order to, so that, like, well, let's keep this regional group together and let's keep, you know, in this country, and then this other group, well, you can be your own country. No. They do it the exact opposite. They draw lines right through the middle of both of them and put them together in the same countries. Maybe they'll create two countries, but they'll put them both there, and, you know, and they'll make them fight with one another. So the way the boundary lines are drawn creates conflict, and it usually it creates conflict, you know, years down the road. Same thing happened in Ukraine. That eastern region had always been ethnically Russian. It was going to go back to Russia. So get with reality. The reality, I know people would like to turn back time and say, oh, it'd be great if we could have that region before they came in. That's not how wars work. They took it. They're not giving it back. Be thankful that they haven't obliterated your major cities yet, because it feels to me like Putin has been holding back quite a bit. Like, he can feel the West trying to bait him into doing something that would give them the justification to escalate this war. Not that they haven't already, but, you know, take it to a new level by blowing up bridges and sending drones deep into Russia and doing all kinds, you know, the sorts of things that Russia said, don't do this. If you do this, we're going to take this to a new level. They always happen, like, right on schedule. So my interest would be in preserving the lives of the Ukrainians who are still here. I mean, there's no good end to this. It's just how much blood do you need? You know, I mean, the American Empire and the British Empire will never be satisfied. There's not enough blood in the world to satisfy them. So you have to stop it at some point, because they will not stop themselves.
I think millions of lives could be saved if the arms stop flowing to perpetuate this war, and you know, a deal was done. And you're saying, Corinne, that they are defending their country, but they've been manipulated into sacrificing their lives by a globalist strategy whereby they've threatened Russia's border, putting NATO, putting bases right on Russia's border. America's got the Monroe Doctrine. And if the thing that, if that was done to America, if someone tried to put something on America's border, what do you think would happen in that situation? If
If they would bomb them to smithereens, that's what they would do. I mean, they would never happen. So this is empire creep. This is NATO start trying to move itself in with at the behest of the American Empire to capture Ukraine and use it as a proxy, as you mentioned. And this is and it just needs to end. The only way this war ends is Russia's not giving up that territory. It's not happening. So either they escalate it to a level that requires a stronger response from Russia, and I cannot even imagine what that would be, or they wrap this up. I think I just err on the side of anti-war. I just don't want war.
We just want people to live, not be sacrificed by banksters. All right, so what are your thoughts on Palantir? That's the next question.
Oh, well, they're not good, if that's what you're asking. This is a dangerous company. This is it's a CIA front company. Okay, their first client was the CIA. They get 97% of their revenue from the Department of Defense, that much in the same way that Oracle's first client was the CIA. In fact, they wound up changing their name to Oracle because they were working on the CIA's Project Oracle, and they just decided, well, let's rebrand after 6 years of work doing this. Let's just call ourselves Oracle. So that's what they've been since the 70s, or the started in 77. I think they changed it in early 80s. So now it's known as Oracle. It's one of the most powerful companies in the world. Larry Ellison started it. He's worth hundreds of billions of dollars. You might have recognized him from partnering with Sam Altman and both being dragged into the Trump administration talking about doing artificial intelligence with medical procedures. So this is a dangerous group coming out of Silicon Valley. I think the most, there's a temptation to say, like, thank God we didn't get Kamala Harris, or everything would be like woke and ridiculous. And it's true, everything would be. But I think we might have stepped on a landmine here with Donald Trump in his relationship with the big tech and Silicon Valley crew, because these guys are the most dangerous people around. They have an interest in keeping us on the animal farm. Peter Thiel, who is the co-founder of Palantir with Alex Karp. Look, not for nothing, these are two homosexual men who don't have any children and have no skin in the game in terms of what they are leaving behind as a legacy on this planet. It's very easy to depopulate. Well, I shouldn't say it's easier to depopulate the planet when you don't have children of your own. You don't have that mindset. You don't have that background. You don't have the feeling of your children being born and how it resets your internal clock on how much you have to care about this planet. You know, I got to care about it, not just my lifetime, but their lifetime as well. These guys don't have that. There's a lot of them in that group. Harari, same thing. Zionists, no kids, talking about depopulation, talking about reimagining society and things like that. This is Palantir is everyone should keep their eyes on this company. And once again, I'm glad people are talking about it. They should. This company's been around since like 2008. So it's not new. They have consolidated their control over the United States military industrial complex under the Trump administration, and their role in targeting so-called terrorists in Gaza is well known. They are the ones that are assigning scores to buildings, and then those scores are the criteria used for deciding whether or not they're going to bomb those buildings and kill everybody in there. So Palantir has blood on their keyboards, so to speak.
All right, folks, get your final questions in for Charlie now, please, as we approach the hour. And I'm curious about your thoughts, Elon Musk's new party.
I am of the belief that you are not going to enact real change through political parties. I think that that system is controlled, and it is it's a brand new corral to keep people ideologically and it subjugated onto this farm. Trust the plan. Elon's going to come and fix it all. My fear for that, like, let's just say, I mean, he has a long track record of not just throwing out crazy ideas, but actually making them happen. But let's just say that he did make this happen. Let's say that he successfully was able to, or he was allowed to, create this third party. I would envision it being run by, or at some point along the way, he making an announcement that, you know, in order to take out the inefficiencies of government or to remove the potential for corruption and bribery, we've gone to more of an AI style of government or governance, you know, where we run the decision through the computer, and we take all the information into account when we, you know, and I could see him doing something along those lines. You know, the founding fathers didn't envision us having this amount of power at our fingertips. Now we can do it, and we should use the amazing power of these computers to tell us how to live, right? That could be the sales pitch for a government technocracy sold to you as an alternative to the two-party duopoly. And of course they would be right to say, and I mean, everybody's tired of that and it doesn't work. And you can see it for what it is. I mean, I also see that a third party wouldn't be any better, but that's how I could see the sales pitch for it moving forward. And it's a crazy idea, but he kind of excels at crazy ideas. So
here's a funny question that ties into Elon. How's that gold in Fort Knox audit coming along?
My assumption is it's coming along exactly as it was designed, which is to say it ain't coming. It's never coming. That's funny.
Let me see. What is Charlie currently working on? Any plans for a new book or a documentary?
As a matter of fact, I am working on a new book. I've been working on this for a few years, though. It's a tough topic. So, yeah, it'll be out when it's out. You know, I just don't want to rush it. And I've got so much information I'm trying to pull from. It's a bit much, but Activist Post, we're doing that. I still suggest everybody who is interested in getting articles every day, go to activistpost.com and add that to your media diet. And I publish articles from really fantastic journalists that are brave, that are doing this around the world, that are telling the truth. And one other thing I am working on, or worked on, past tense, but it's now available, is Barnum World, the new mockumentary. The mockumentary to end all documentaries is how they've pitched this. It's called Barnum World. It's from the guys who did Jones Plantation movie, which came out in 2023, and it's free on YouTube and Rumble, and it's going to be on a bunch of streaming platforms as well. It's following a character called Matty Jones, who's a Hollywood big shot producer, who finally sits down for a tell-all interview with me. I'm sort of the off-camera interviewer, and to explain the game, how it works, what it is, why it is, what the system does, what it doesn't. And he's an unusually likable guy, even though he's a Hollywood scumbag. You notice during the course of the film that he never really lies to anybody. He just tells them the truth, but unfortunately the truth is something they don't want to hear. So it's a great movie for people in our world, but also if there's a normie in your life and you want to show them these topics that we cover, but you don't, you know, it's a little too heavy to like hammer them over the head, like, hey, sit down and watch this really intense video of what's going on in Gaza. You're not going to get your friends that way. But if you want them to watch comedy, a mockumentary, it's just a kind of a spoof on all this stuff. It's a great way to deliver bad news. And Lee Gallman, who plays Natty Jones in this, also played Mr. Jones in Jones Plantation movie. He's a star. He's fantastic. If you're on Twitter X, you'll know him as Legal Man, U.S. Crime Review, at U.S. Crime Review, I think. And he is a lawyer who has turned into a hell of an actor accidentally, you know, by Jones Plantation and now this. I encourage people to take a look. It's fantastic. Watch the first 10 minutes. You'll be hooked.
We started on Epstein. We'll finish on Epstein. This is from Cassandra. It is, to me, it is clear Epstein was an intelligence agent of some kind. Is it possible that at some point the relationship the US has with the Israelis will implode? Ooh.
Hopefully. They're both, they're perfect for each other, though. You know what I mean? They're colonizers and land stealers and liars and murderers and thieves, and they're perfect for the, you know, the American Empire and the Israeli Empire, you know, whatever you want to call it. They're two peas in a pod. I can envision them working together for a long, long time. But in any sort of great heist whodunit movie, you know, the two bad guys eventually off each other. So at some point, you know, because, you know, two men can keep a secret if one of them's dead, right? So I had envisioned that at some point there maybe might be a bit of a turf war or a civil war between the two. And who would win in a situation like that? Humanity.
It's always a great pleasure, my friend. Thank you for coming on. Is there anything you'd like to say in conclusion to the viewers?
No, I just, I'm grateful for the opportunity to come on here. You and I've done a lot of work on Epstein over the years, and he's a polarizing top, you know, figure. And I encourage people to, take a look at, you know, at all the other projects he was involved in. Take a look at the little Sophia AI robot doll, you know, based on the big Sophia doll that he built with Ben Goertzel. If you want to get creeped out for, you know, that. So again, I'm glad people are talking about this guy. I hope it doesn't end with this. If you find this sort of information grossly interesting, which I think we all kind of do, then you will be surprised to know that Jeffrey Epstein was involved in a variety of other fraudulent activities and criminality. And you dig down that rabbit hole, you'll find quite a bit. And the people connected to him came from every industry you could imagine, not just political guys and bankers, but scientists and you name it. So it's the gift that keeps on giving. It's been my pleasure to explore the Epstein network with you over the years, Sean. So thanks for having me on.
Touche, my friend. I'm going to let you go and close the show, and you take care. Cheers.
Sounds good.
Thank you. All right. What a phenomenal guest, folks. And Charlie's links are in the description box. I'll put some of them in the live chat. We're still editing the Epstein niece Anya Wick video. It is mind-blowing. Cult of Baal, Bohemian Grove, the Clintons. I think I've got a guest coming on tomorrow who was in a satanic defilation ritual survivor. I'm just going to double check that when I get off this stream. I've been in London today doing school talks all day, so I've fallen a little bit behind on what's coming up next on the schedule. And we are possibly going to get Kathy O'Brien back on with Roseanne in a couple of weeks. So they are some of the big ones to look forward to. I see Professor Hamamoto in the chat. We've had some great streams with the professor recently. Shout out to you, and thank you for joining us this evening, folks, and hope to see some of you tomorrow.